story box.
According to my calculations, we are now approaching the sun. It's getting really hot in here.
I'm so hot. Check me out. I'm hot. Yo, everyone, I'm the sun. I'm made of gas like hydrogen and helium. I keep the earth warm and help to grow food. I shine on the beach on guys who say, yeah. I set into the west and on comes night. And then I rise from the east with that golden light. I'm so hot, so hot and bright. 28 million degrees
Fahrenheit.
I make plants grow like trees and flowers. So powerful. Got that solar power. Make the deserts dry, make the oceans rise. Don't stare right at me, I could hurt your eyes. I'm just about a million miles wide. I'm so big you could fit a million Earths inside. I'm the center of the solar system, can't you see? Got so much gravity, planets orbit me. I'm 4.5 billion years old. In Spanish, everybody calls me Sol. When I'm not around, you'll be feeling cold. Yeah, I shine so bright with my rays of gold.
I'm so hot,
I'm so hot. Come on, StoryBot, show me what you got. How hot am I?
So hot. The sun is so hot, I have to wear these. Now I'm cool. So cool.
Well, we'll dedicate that to the All-Father Sun. Yeah, that's right. Who gives everlasting life to the earth, the only sun you really need. I mean, in that sense, that's right. The All-Father Sun. And all of that stuff about Jesus is simply an allegory for the All-Father Sun. This is Terrible Tommy in the Bunker, right here in North Central Indiana, on April the 9th, 2015, Thursday. Yeah. We're already getting down towards... Boy, I'll tell you, these weeks go so fast. But we're getting rain back here, and supposedly going to get wilder. I got some lightning and thunder this morning. But we're supposed to get some real heavy stuff as time goes on. But you know how those weather people are. Not like California. California, Southern California weathermen, it's very simple. We're going to have haze in the morning, burning off at noon, and nice, pleasant, sunshiny afternoon. Back here, hell, you don't know what's going to happen. And we're right here at Terrible Tommy's Tavern, right next to Terrible Tommy's equipment yard, weapons of mass destruction equipment yard. And we got a lot of new stuff out there, and we're open now. But when it's raining, don't come down here, because we stick in the bar and sing karaoke when it's like that. Yeah, and like today when it's raining. We don't want my boys to go out there and get wet. Okay, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your tons of money. And that's where you send your snail mail. And but for orders, you send that to merchandiseresist@yahoo.com. And the webmaster will take care of you. That's right. If you miss a show or something, go to email that particular email address, and you'll be taken care of. Yeah. So, and then go up to resist.com, our Harvard College type university outfit. There you can get all the education you want. More education than you'll need to become a first-class white separatist, lone wolf. Well, here we go. Now, look here. All these blacks getting shot by the cops. Well, the one thing I think you pretty well figured out is that the best way to act when you're told to stop by a cop is stop. If he says put up your hands, you put up your hands. And in most cases, you're not going to get shot. There might be one whacked out cop once in a while that might do that, but in the most cases you don't run. Niggers evolve so far from the jungle that they're used to running from everything. The lions, the tigers, the snakes, you name it. So it's almost an evolutionary habit to run. And on the other hand, since we are higher animals and we're predatory, the white man is, because he has evolved to the top of the food chain, is used to being the one that's chasing. And so his primordial instincts arise when something runs from him, another animal. Lower on the evolutionary chain, and it tends to kick in all his primordial predatory habits, whether he likes it or not. And unless a person is very well controlled, absolutely iron fast controlled, he's going to do something that is not in his best interest, like the cop did down in Georgia or wherever it was. And I'm not kidding you. This is what's going on. It's fight or flight. But the Negro is the pursued, and the cop is the predatory white man. And he is, if he is not, in other words, if he goes by his absolute predatory nature, how he evolved over millions of years, he's going to shoot the damn individual or chase him down and beat the hell out of him, because that's his predatory nature of chasing another animal. And the black, he's used to running, and he just don't quite understand that if this man that was shot down there in Georgia, if he'd have simply stood there, put up his hands and faced the cop and followed his instructions, he'd be alive. And the cop wouldn't be charged with murder. So what do you think about that? Pretty logical to me. So the problem being that the vast amount of people forget the evolved human that evolved from the animal world. He's a higher animal, and he's had millions of years to develop that way. And the predator has had millions of years of chasing subspecies or whatever you want to call them. It's as simple as that. But as long as you fail to understand that and fail to apply it and work with it, you're going to have this kind of problem. Now, the other thing is, now you're going to see even a lot more problems, because they're going to equip all these cops with cameras. Well, you see, what happens there is that you forget about the camera. In a tense situation, high-stress situation, you forget the camera is on you. So there's going to be more and more cops get into trouble. It's going to be worse. And there are going to be a lot more lawsuits by the pursued against the predator who is the pursuer. So it's going to be interesting as time goes on, because, number one, the Negro will never admit that, I guess I should have just stopped and put up my hands and faced the cop and taken my medicine. He's not going to do that. He's going to, the white man's always chasing me. He'd been predatorizing me for a long time in the jungle. He even chased me all the time, just like the tigers and the lions and the leopards and all of them. They chase my ass, you know. So immediately, when I see that white cop, I'm going to turn around and run, because I know he's a predator son of a bitch. But now you owe me millions of dollars in reparations, man, because you've been chasing me for hundreds and thousands of years. You got to quit chasing me, man. Got to quit chasing me. Well, if you'd adopt the white man's rules, well, you wouldn't get chased all the time. It's as simple as that, Rastus. No cop I ever knew wanted to chase niggers around. They prefer they put up their hands and face them, because they don't want to chase niggers down dark alleys and all that kind of crap. So you see, there's logical answers to about everything, and usually those answers are fairly simple if you just go by common sense and reason. You can figure them out. But Obama hasn't called me up to the White House to get my opinion and instructions, so I guess we'll just have to go on with the predatory cops chasing the universally chased nigger. But the black man can't help it. He is condemned forever to be the pursued. And he can't help it. He's got to run, man, because that predatory white guy is coming to go and get him, you know, even if he's not trying to get him. The other problem is the cops have gotten soft white men, and are using the speeding bullet to catch their prey. They used to, you know, run them down and eat them or whatever they did to them, but now they said, I'm too lazy to chase that Negro. I'm going to just use my bullet to catch up with him. Yeah, that's what they're doing, man.
This is Walter Dennis. I'd like to ask you something. What would America's founding fathers have done if they knew that someday a black man would be president of the United States? Our first president, George Washington, and many of his compatriots owned thousands of Negro slaves. Others, such as Thomas Jefferson, tried deporting America's black population to a West African state still known as Liberia. He wrote into the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, that a Negro shall be considered only 3/5 of a person, a non-citizen, unable to vote. Today, if you travel to our nation's capital, you'll read the following words inscribed in stone on the Jefferson Memorial. Quote, "Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people, the Negroes, are to be free." Unquote. Thomas Jefferson's statement is allowed to end there, leaving visitors with the impression that our third president was a liberal integrationist. But this quotation from his autobiography has been taken out of its original context. Someone has selectively deleted the rest of Jefferson's words, which are, quote, "Nor is it less certain that the two races, equally free, cannot live in the same government. Nature, habit, opinion have drawn indelible lines of distinction between them." Unquote. But what about Abraham Lincoln? He freed the slaves, so he must have loved them. Liberals like to imagine that by calling upon his memory, they lend authority to their racially integrated agendas. But this is what Lincoln said during his fourth presidential debate on September 18, 1858. Quote, "I will say then that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the black and white races. That I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say, in addition to this, that there is a physical difference between the black and white races which will ever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race." Unquote. Today, any politician running for public office, in fact, anyone making such a statement, would be loudly condemned as a racist of the worst possible kind, expelled from school or fired from his job, and arrested on charges of committing a hate crime. Yet, Lincoln, Jefferson, and Washington are supposed to be our country's great icons. No teacher, no one in the news or entertainment media will ever tell you what these men actually believed about so-called Afro-Americans. Nor will they tell you that blacks are responsible for more than 80% of violent crimes committed in our country, even though Negroes make up just 12% of its population. That must come as a shock to regular viewers of television, where blacks are around half the faces seen on the tube. Unlike their real-life versions, televised blacks are almost invariably portrayed as pitiful victims of injustice at the hands of white bigots, or lovable heroes deserving our adoration and emulation. This is because television is nothing more than a backed-up toilet overflowing with lies. It is a font of poison floating with stinking falsehoods in which truth dies and sinks. Beginning after the turn of the last century, race-mixing propagandists have taken particular delight in elevating half-breeds to superstar status. Television personalities and political celebrities of black and white parentage are more often placed upon the highest public pedestals for special homage. At the same time, no opportunity is missed to promote racially mixed unions, typically of a blonde white woman to a blue-black male, together with the couple's half-breed offspring, which invariably take after their African father. When we look around the world at racially mixed countries, we find such exotic lands as India, Morocco, and Mexico. These places are human garbage dumps, characterized by squalor, violence, starvation, filth, and disease on a colossal scale of hopeless misery. They were not always so. 4,000 years ago, a civilization of clean-swept boulevards and magnificent public baths flourished throughout the Indus Valley. 2,000 years later, Morocco was set with marble temples and gleaming health spas, a jewel in the crown of the Roman Empire. 500 years ago, conquistadors from Spain raised a prosperous colony upon the ruins of Aztec Indian human sacrifice and cannibalism. All of these formerly high cultures in Mexico, Morocco, and India were created exclusively by white civilizers. While colored natives may have supplied some of the labor, civilization was the product of white genius. So long as the white master builders preserved their dominance and racial integrity, society functioned as intended. But as they interbred with Negroes and other lowlife, white identity drowned in a raceless morass of darkening generations that bore less and less resemblance to their fair-skinned founding fathers. Their originally high intelligence level sank into an increasingly dumber and savage population. The once splendid civilizations of the Indus Valley, Central America, and North Africa decayed into the rotting urban centers now known as New Delhi, Tijuana, or Marrakesh. America stands in the same shadow that eventually reduced these formerly civilized centers to subhuman cesspools. Such putrid places graphically represent the goal set for our country by fanatic integrationists who embrace race mixing with all the fervor of religious extremists. Their aim is to reduce the United States to another Bangladesh or Sudan. The mass murderers of our posterity flaunt their sympathy for the colored downtrodden of this world in order to parade what they imagine is a kind of moral superiority over everyone else. These people are truly insane. Their real core motivation is a psychopathic loathing for everything and everyone white. That only can explain such hysterical intolerance of the slightest criticism for the race-mixed utopia they demand. They cannot work fast enough for the eventual extirpation of the white race through wholesale interbreeding with Congoid apes. Their aim is the dissolution of all the world's races into a single global souffle of genetic excrement. And anyone who raises an objection to their high-minded nightmare is condemned and ostracized as a racist, an enemy to what is ever fair and good. Yet, what we take for granted today as civilization is the exclusive product of white men and women. From computers and hair curlers to bicycles and space shuttles, everything we know as modern technology was brought about entirely by white inventors. It stands to reason that when their kind no longer exists, their creations will disintegrate, just like old American cars falling apart in the littered streets of Mexico City. While white people were building great civilizations around the world for the last 5,000 years, blacks in Africa never figured out how to make a wheel. They never built anything more substantial than a mud hut. They knew nothing about metal, glass, or tool. They never had a written language. Their technology did not extend beyond the tip of their wood spears. Their only medicine was voodoo. They never sailed on anything greater than a floating log, even though they resided along thousands of miles of coastline. And all this centuries before they could claim slavery as an excuse for their utter lack of know-how. They never put one stone upon another, thought of a light bulb, invented an airplane, designed a fountain pen, wrote a poem, painted a portrait, or initiated anything associated with civilized life. Although Afro-Americans have come to benefit from these things and more, they created none of them. They have always excelled, however, in those activities which characterize them best: violent behavior and monumental squalor. For proof, drive through the south side of Chicago, into Gary, Indiana, or black streets in any metropolitan area, if you dare. There you will see old, rotting buildings tottering above gang-infested sinkholes of urban filth. These are the ruins of white civilization, microcosms for what the rest of America is becoming. This national decay translates itself into escalating murders, assaults, rapes, robberies, and a virtual tidal wave of atrocities committed daily against white men, women, and children. Considered more important than their own self-defense, they are cautioned against racism when identifying their dark assailants. Because followers of the race-mixing dogma are indifferent to these white victims, outsiders rarely learn of their fate. They are not showcased on television, nor featured on the front page of a major newspaper. For example, a few years ago, charges were leveled against Duke University students accused of gang raping an innocent black girl. Months before the high-profile case collapsed because their ultra-liberal prosecutor was disbarred for falsifying the evidence against them, and the accuser herself turned out to be a lying half-wit, they were tried and found guilty by every major American newspaper and television network. The young white men were simultaneously and universally castigated as racists of the most awful type, meriting the severest punishment. Reverends Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson made daily telecasts deploring the climate of intolerance and sick racism that pervades our country. FBI spokesmen speculated that the alleged gang rape was a hate crime. Social services liberals swung into action to provide counseling and financial assistance for the bogus black victim and her family. While the falsely accused white students were being vilified across the nation week after week, Americans were pointedly not informed of another, this time authentic atrocity that was absolutely boycotted, deliberately ignored, hushed up, even censored from public knowledge. In a successful effort to contain all outside awareness of the story, no network anchorman or mainstream reporter announced the arrest in Kentucky of four black men and one black female for perpetrating some of the most ghastly crimes ever committed in U.S. history. They were accused of abducting and murdering a young white couple. While his girlfriend looked on, they castrated Christopher Newsom, 24, then burned him alive and fired several shots into him. Over the next several days, the satanic savages beat and raped his girlfriend, Shannon Christian, 23, and took turns urinating on her. On the fourth day, they cut off her breasts, stuffed a large variety of toxic chemicals, including floor cleaner, into her mouth, then slowly stabbed her to death. Not a word about this unspeakable crime was heard on the nightly news, because NBC, CBS, CNN, ABC, Fox, and all the rest of the alphabetical deceivers were obsessed at the time with the phony Duke University rape case. There was no appeal to the sensitivities of millions of regular viewers. No social services liberals thought to comfort the families of the white victims. The torture and murder of two young white people by five blacks is not a hate crime in the FBI's book, and Reverends Sharpton and Jackson had nothing to say. Their silence is part of the deliberate censorship of any information harmful to the artificial, false image of blacks perpetrated by America's news media masters. They realize that such censorship of the truth is vital to their race-mixing agenda. Yet we are invited to embrace these killer gorillas as our equals, no, as our physical, moral, and intellectual superiors. What then can we expect for the future? Unchecked, the forces of decline will climax in mid-century. Given the continuous and accelerating inundation of the United States by waves of immigrants from south of the border Africa, Asia, India, and the Middle East, our continent's white population will have slipped to minority status before 2050. By then, our race will have become so polluted through interbreeding with subhumans, its identity will be progressively marginalized until it no longer exists. The next 40 years will also witness America's inevitable economic conquest by Red China and India, the very countries past U.S. presidents were so anxious to assist. Our standard of living will plummet to levels comparable with Ecuador or Somalia. Companies and businesses here will be largely Asian-owned, and Americans will have to work for mostly colored bosses. The U.S. dollar will eventually become so weak it must be replaced by some international currency. With health care largely in the hands of physicians from Pakistan or the Philippines, medical help will be rendered virtually useless, and certainly unable to keep pace with too many viral strains introduced by the endless deluge of germ-carrying colored immigrants. As in any fundamental social dislocation, a tsunami of criminal bloodshed will sweep across North America. Since white people by then will have been disarmed by gun control fanatics, their spirit of resistance diluted by decades of instilled health self-hatred, and all police forces predominantly black and brown, pale-faced victims can expect little protection and less mercy. They will suffer the same kind of massacres carried out in the past against hapless whites by Indian savages on the American plains. By then, the Bill of Rights promised that, quote, the right of the people to bear arms, unquote, will have been wiped away by the enemies of white America. One of its most prominent founders, Thomas Jefferson, insisted that, quote, no free man shall ever be debarred the use of arms against tyranny in government. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants, unquote. In the years to come, only ruins and garbage will be left to show that the world was once inhabited by temporarily civilized but ultimately self-destructive human beings. Sounds like a rather bleak scenario for the future. That certainly is what the evangelists of race mixing want us to believe. Things have gone too far for some white Americans. They have given up without a fight, resigned themselves and their posterity to defeat and oblivion. They point out the shameful fact that a black man, worse, a mongrel half-breed, is now President of the United States. It was not the combined support of Negroes and Hispanics that won the election for him. Their endorsement could have been expected. No, he was voluntarily installed in the White House by a solid majority of white voters, the same people being exterminated by the very elements he himself personally embodies. More than 65 years ago, Adolf Hitler warned U.S. servicemen during World War II that their taking up arms against his racially aware country would inevitably backfire on them by putting a Negro in the White House. They laughed at him. The vast majority of white Americans in the 1940s regarded blacks then as little more than subhuman clowns, hardly worthy of attention. The very notion of a black-faced president had more in common with a comedy skit than anything in the foreseeable future. Yet, some of those Second World War veterans who once thought Hitler's prediction so amusing are no longer laughing. A colored chief executive was unthinkable, ludicrous even, until the early 1970s, when big city mayoral positions and state governorships were first occupied by Negroes. If a black mayor, some argued, why not a black president someday? Coincidental with the blacks advancing political power, all mainstream avenues of public information joined at every level of education to wring the last ounce of racial self-respect from our people. They were psychologically conditioned to embrace every manifestation of racial suicide in a comprehensive campaign as ubiquitous as it was relentless. A two-prong attack morally undercut white Americans by stressing their original sin of racism while constantly heroizing blacks as altogether superior, lovable creatures. Only decades of unrelieved and concerted propaganda made a Negro president possible. Without this incessant programming, such an incomparable disgrace would never have come to pass. Blacks are self-evidently too dim-witted to have achieved anything on their own. They represent merely a means to an end, namely the lethal pollution of our race. Once a white people have been poisoned by interbreeding, they disappear forever from the face of the earth, never to return. The original white builders of Egypt, Iran, Persia, India, and all the other lands that so long ago flourished, utterly vanished, their formerly vibrant cultures reduced to dead ruins when they renounced the irreplaceable heritage of their pure blood. Racially weakened, their societies were beset by uncontrollable criminal violence, moral rot, economic collapse, political corruption, and cultural decay, until foreigners obliterated them. As the historian Will Durant warned us during the last century, quote, "A great civilization is not conquered from without until it has destroyed itself from within," unquote. America is not exempt from that iron law, with Red China poised to take over from the United States as the next superpower. Accordingly, the U.S. seems doomed to repeat the same kind of suicide committed by past civilizations, and nothing can be done to stop it so long as the majority of Americans are either indifferent to their country's fate or actually aiding and abetting it. So, what are you going to do? Let it go? Will you allow yourself to be pushed into the background and told to shut up, afraid to raise your voice in a feeble word of protest? Isn't there anything you can do that really matters? There is, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with complaining to your congressman, signing petitions, or writing to a newspaper editor. Your enemies brush aside such obsolete methods with a contemptuous laugh. The very first thing you have got to do is get mad. No one can do anything really meaningful unless they're consumed with justifiable anger. God knows you have more to be enraged about than you can even imagine. But you know enough about white kids beaten by Afro-American gangsters. You know enough about white women raped and tortured by black monsters. You know enough about the anti-white lies you're supposed to swallow in silence. You've got to get up and shout in the face of your enemy, "I'm a white American, damn it, and I'm not going to take your race-mixing crap anymore." The psychotic negrophiles are quick to denounce and label anyone who fails to embrace their savage yahoos as haters. But if you cannot hate someone who threatens your own loved ones with suffering and death, you're a failure as a human being. Anyone who won't defend those they love for fear of giving offense is a worthless coward. We can and will no longer be silenced by the race-mixing bullies pushing our world towards extinction. We will no longer be made ashamed of being white while others insist on black pride. We will not allow ourselves to be weakened by all those numerous, relatively petty differences that divide white men and keep us from forming a united front against the haters of our betrayed people. Those differences, how otherwise significant they may seem, must be put aside and not allowed to deflect one degree from our unity as white men and women. We must draw our wagons into a circle, close up our ranks in an unbreakable flank. Political, religious, class, ideological, or any of the other sorts of differences that threaten to divide our racial solidarity must be avoided. All that counts now is our self-awareness as white men and women. And anyone who attempts to detract one ounce from our racial unity has joined the enemies of white America. That the majority hates us or simply doesn't care about the survival of white America means nothing. When George Washington and his fellow revolutionaries took on the British Empire, the most powerful machine of its kind on earth, they were opposed by a solid majority of their own countrymen. Most people couldn't have cared less one way or the other. More than a third of Americans hated the Patriots, who were supported by just 15% of the colonial population. And from that small minority, only a fractional percentage actually participated in the war for independence. Yet, these few activists, against the will of a pro-British majority, themselves embodied a majority of willpower and energy to expel powerful invaders from our country. The American patriots who achieved this miracle were not liberals. They did not love their enemies. They were proud to be robust haters of the foreigners who imposed a frightful tyranny on the United States. The same situation confronts us today. Most white Americans are indifferent to the present decline and future destruction of their own race. To them, the only things that matter are making money and wasting their lives watching television. A majority of our fellow countrymen and women have been reduced to brainwashed lemmings, but not all of them. National election results for the past few years, where race-conscious candidates have run for office, have conclusively shown that 15% of our people understand and loathe the anti-white haters who have pushed us to the brink of extinction. That doesn't sound like much, but 15% of the U.S. population fleshes out into 37 million race-conscious white Americans. Within those 37 millions lies a 3% minority of 75,000 potential activists, a veritable army of warriors. The chief task of the anti-white establishment has always been to drive a wedge between the 37 million white people who have not yet lost their souls to race mixing and the 75,000 fighters who can lead them to victory over the corruptors of our racial integrity. Anyone who can appreciate the high significance of these percentages understands at once that he or she is not an isolated individual, a freak for refusing to embrace the race-mixed propaganda of our times, unlike most everyone else. On the contrary, there are millions and millions of white Americans just as inwardly disgusted and repelled by the colored pollution of our people as we are ourselves. These numbers may encourage us, but our resistance must not depend on them. If the spirits of America's proudly racist founding fathers could return to see how we, their descendants, have allowed the liberty they fought and died for to have been stolen by repulsive fugitives from the African jungle, they would command us as Patrick Henry did. "We must fight," he said. Listen to these words he spoke more than 200 years ago. Quote, "I repeat it, sir, we must fight. An appeal to arms and the God of hosts is all that is left to us. Should I keep back my opinions at such a time through fear of giving offense, I should consider myself as guilty of treason toward my country. Why stand we here idle? What is it that the gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." Unquote. That is the real American spirit that defied all the powers of hell and stood up to the hostile majority and won. It is a spirit no longer seen in our fellow countrymen, because they have been lulled to sleep by the criminal conspirators against our lives, our liberty, and our posterity. How many more of our friends and family have to be mugged by black or Hispanic cowardly punks before you're mad enough to fight? How many more white kids are you going to allow to be beaten by colored gangbangers? How many more formerly white women must mate with darksome subhumans and bear their degraded offspring before our race is bred out of existence? For God's sake, man, get some guts! If you think things are bad now, just wait until 2040, when white people slip to minority status in the U.S. We've already become a minority in the American Southwest, and in major cities such as Chicago, where the white residents have been reduced to just one quarter of the total population, with a resultant spike in violent crime across the Windy City. Today, white people are already outnumbered by 8-to-1 odds on Earth. The American countdown has begun. Every 29 seconds, another illegal alien penetrates the United States. Every 10 minutes, another poisonous half-breed is spawned inside our borders. These hard facts embody the harsh truth about the real condition of our country. Get this through your head. America is threatened with death. Our struggle is for nothing less than our survival. Nothing in our lives is more important. No sacrifice we can make on its behalf too great. This struggle also ennobles us, however. It provides anyone who personally champions its cause the highest self-respect, because it embodies the brightest truth in this age of lies. The truth, hidden or knocked to the ground, always rises again to reveal itself. But it is not enough to see through the anti-white bias of our day. In itself, the most magnificent sword is no more than an inanimate object until someone has the courage to grasp it firmly by the handle and wield it against his enemies. So, too, a hidden truth is worthless until it is unsheathed and used to boldly cut down all liars. Patrick Henry and his fellow patriots knew the hard truth of their times and were brave enough to raise it in defense of liberty. They were not black or Latino or Jewish or octoroon, such as that racial anomaly in the White House. His installation is only a benchmark in the death of the United States. More significantly, however, it is a national wake-up call that remaining 15% of white Americans yet aware of their own racial identity can hear and understand. It means that the hour for their survival is very late. The alarm is blaring with terrible urgency. Let that same signal also reignite the revolutionary spark of our white forefathers. Let it catch your own soul on fire and spread its flames across our betrayed nation. Some 65 years ago, a nameless hero, one among millions of warriors, declared, quote, "In times of gravest danger, the soul of our people erupts with elemental force to fend off all mortal blows and to assert itself. The soul's energy proves itself stronger than any numerical or material superiority. General readiness escalates to the highest action. What does his life mean to the individual if the sacred life of his race is threatened? He sacrifices himself so that that greater life is won. Superhuman feats are performed, and the word impossible is no longer known." Unquote. White America isn't dead yet. On the contrary, the sleeping giant is stirring from his propaganda-induced trance. And when he fully awakens, the puny enemies and congenital liars that scheme to kill him in his sleep will scatter like diseased vermin at the sight of his all-consuming rage. On your feet, white man! Stand up and fight!
Now, what I want people to do is copy this, make CDs out of it. I can copy CDs one at a time, but I can't copy more than one. We need somebody to get on a machine and copy these onto CDs and start putting them around every place you can, but not just thrown out of onto the lawns and stuff like that. I found that to be very ineffective. You got to put them in the politicians' offices, on the newspaper steps, television, radio, and like that, and send them into talk show hosts and so forth. But we got to do something like that. I think it could make a lot, build a lot more resistance if we did that. You know, people ask me quite a bit, why don't you push for the Palestinians more and some of these other people? Well, in their own lands, I do. But they don't stay in their own lands, and most of them are non-white, and they come here. And I didn't invite them, and I don't think most Americans invited them. Or somebody may say, well, why don't you make a contact with ISIS? I don't want homeland insecurity down here. Well, anyhow, the point is that ISIS is Muslim. And Muslim is race mixing. It's very clear in the Quran that race mixing is fine. In fact, they promote it even more than the Christians. And they know that they have to do that so they can spread their myths all over the world. And if they said, well, it's only for white people or only for brown people, well, they wouldn't get so far. That's the only reason different religion uses that. And here again, I'm not for anybody that is non-white that comes into this country by the hundreds, by the thousands, or even singularly to take the place of white people. Now, in their own country, I hope they drive the U.S. forces out of the Middle East. I hope they do. Not because I hate the forces, but I'm trying to save white lives. I want to bring back here, get them out all over the world. What, 700 or 800 bases around the world? Most of them are in non-white countries. We don't want them. We don't want our white young people going over there. And I got the big sign out to put it up yesterday. Are you 17? If so, tell the U.S. Army recruiter that comes to your school to kiss your ass. I get a hell of a lot of young people who go by my house on the way to high school, which is only about a half a mile away, and they see that. They're going to talk about it. They're going to talk about it in the classes and getting debates and arguments with their teachers and so forth like that. But ISIS, whatever they want to do in the Middle East, that's their business. That's none of my business. But you're going to find out, like I found out years ago, that supporting the Palestinian-type situation doesn't do you much good because the Palestinians are basically, you know, mostly non-white. And I told you many times when I was in New York City one time with my son John doing a TV show, they were having a pro-Palestinian parade. And so down on the main drag. So we went down to see what was going on, and they had all kinds of people, a big parade, everything supporting the Palestinians. But guess what? It was full of the people from this country, mostly white and Jewish and so forth, that are enemies. And so I said, well, that we can't support the Palestinians. I don't support the Palestinians. And it was funny because the Jewish Defense League was there screaming at the Palestinians. Jewish Defense League was whiter than the Palestinians. So, and there's tens of thousands of non-white Palestinians have streamed into this country. They have shown no respect to our race. No respect whatsoever. They just said, the State Department says, we's all equal, so they all said, we'll go on in there. But they know they're hated by a lot of people for their color and their different culture and so forth. So anyhow, any group that wants to add to our problems of muddying up the racial water in this country, I can't have anything to do with them. And I've told them, many of them, you go back to your own country, and I support you, you know, ideologically. Well, not maybe ideologically, but I don't care. It's your country. It's your Middle East. Kick the shit out of whoever comes into it. And if you want to kick the shit out of each other like you're doing all the time, that's all right because it's family quarrels. Not me. It's not my race. There are salvageable whites in the Middle East that I would accept into the United States. I see a lot of whites in the Iranian population, blue-eyed, even blonde hair and like that. So we're number one for the white race worldwide, and we'll do whatever we can to work with those people if they're not bogged down with this Christ insanity or Islam. Because if they are, they're not, as far as I'm concerned, they're no good to us. They're no good to us at all. So don't expect me to start breaking bread. Now, the only thing I put out today, I sent out about George Lincoln Rockwell speaking twice before the black Muslims. And I was invited to speak before them too. There was a problem because Farrakhan got stuck over in Africa, and State Department was rattling his cases that like they were going to arrest him when he come back, so that all fell through. But the only contact I've had with the Nation of Islam is that they're black separatists, and I'm a white separatist. I don't think they're really honest about it. I don't think they're really fighting for black separation. But for the publicity of the thing and driving the Jews crazy and everybody else, I donated $100 at that meeting in Long Beach, California, or Inglewood, California, at the forum. 20,000 blacks in there, and It was I and about seven of my security people there. So they roped off a special spot for us to sit. They treated us with utmost respect. I've always been treated much better, really, by black separatists than most of the right wing. That's for sure. So that's my position on that, because you can't be a hypocrite. I hate hypocrites. They're the worst kind of people, hypocrites. I respect a man, you know, like a black said about me in the jail when I was getting out of jail up there, and I was surrounded by blacks, and the deputies made sure they pointed me out, too, thinking the blacks, I guess, were going to beat the shit out of me. And there were some there that wanted to beat up on me. There was eight of them in the room, and I was the only white guy. And they could have pretty well done me in before the deputies would have even thought of coming in and breaking it up. But they were giving me a hard time, and the one black guy says, hey, lay off this guy. He's all right. He talks straight. He's honest with you. He's going to call you a nigger to your face, not like these other hypocrite whites. You lay off him. And so that sort of bugged the deputies, white deputies. They were only about 8 feet away across the hall, and they heard the whole thing. And I know it pissed them off, because they like to get, a lot of these deputies like to get white people beat the shit out of it, even killed in jail for the fun of it. Many of these cops are psychopaths. There's no doubt about that. And the ones that work in a jail are usually the worst. And I told you before, if they wanted cops to be halfway decent on the street, they wouldn't take them out of the academy and send them right out to the jail. They do that in L.A. They take them right out of the academy, fresh new guys, and send them to work in the jail, where the worst kind of people in the world are there, black, white, you name it. So their first really presence to these people is a terrible, terrible impression leaves on these guys, and they become psychopaths at that point in the jail. So then once they get out of the jail, they put them out on the street, and guess how they're going to act? They want to beat up everybody. So anyhow, that's my position on that. And so you Middle Eastern people, it's your land. Kick the shit out of anybody who tries to take it away from you, including your own brother, you know? But don't expect me to break bread with you while you're pouring thousands and tens of thousands of your non-white people with your screwball religion into my country. This is my territory, and it will be fought for sooner or later. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. But the white man's got to get his nose stuck in it really, really bad before he'll come out swinging. And that might be too late, but they will be swinging. And you know as well as I do, there's no more dangerous, brutal, ruthless man on the face of the earth than a white man that comes out swinging. I mean, we didn't get to where we're at by being pussies. I mean, the majority of the white race is like anybody else and pretty much pussies. But the kind that really lead the race, they come out swinging and kill anybody gets in their way. And what we have to have is a few thousand men and women that are like Bob Matthews on steroids. None of us today are tough enough, rough enough, and vicious enough to lead what's going to come in the future. I'm sorry. I met some pretty tough white boys, and I'm not exactly a pansy, but even I do not have the qualities to bring on what has to come on maybe 10, 15, 20 years down the road. It's got to be that man of the North swinging his battle axe, and anybody gets in his way, he's going to take him out. And if non-whites don't want to separate and get out of the way, they're going to be exterminated at some point, unless the white man just totally gives up. Unless he just totally gives up, which he has done. He's given up a lot. But I have confidence in the primal urge of the white man that at some point a significant percentage will get the job done. So I'm optimistic about that. And to be perfectly honest, the percentage of white people I met in the right wing and the, you know, Klan and NS and all of that stuff are not worth the paper their name is written on. I'm sorry. Just a few, a small percentage are great, but the rest of them, they're worthless. They're less than worthless. They're dangerous. I don't know whether you guys know this or not. You probably do, because I'm always the last to know a lot of things. But if you get a strange readout on a phone number you don't recognize comes into your place, well, they say you can go and dial that number on Google and it'll come back who it is or what kind of a dealer, if it's a company or whether it's an individual or what. Dial that number on Google. I'm going to start trying that. I never heard of that before. There's a gal who wrote a book, and I forgot the title, but I didn't write it down. And they put forth the idea that the more choices you have in any particular situation, whether it be groceries or cars or what it is, the more choices you have, the more confused you get. Now, that's pretty understandable, but with candidates for office, they said that maybe a half a dozen would be fine, but if you went to, say, 15, you'd be confused. So it pointed out the numerical number of choices you have a direct result on the intelligence of the choice you take. So I often wonder in a grocery store when I see hundreds of cereals, different brands, and all these kind of things, thinking, why in the hell do we need so many choices like that? We could have just half a dozen of them and be fine. Store wouldn't have to be so big. But people just, their brain gets turned off and get confused. Remember this, you can't fix a dysfunctional world if you try to change it with a dysfunctional country. We have a dysfunctional country and we're trying through empire to run the world. And dysfunctional people or societies cannot help others to get rid of being dysfunctional. You get it? That's from Tommy Sayings. Interesting that Obomsky is meeting with some representatives of South American countries this weekend, but he's meeting with Raul Castro. Boy, Cuba may be poor, but they've got a lot of good things going for them, too, as a socialist country. And I think it might be the destruction of Cuba to allow predatory capitalism back in. You know what I mean? I think they were probably doing better in the long run culturally as a nation than if you go back in there and allow predatory capitalism and all the gambling casinos and everything and bring that old Jewish decadence back into Cuba. You know, I'm beginning to think that we did have visitors from outer space and maybe are having them now. And my theory is that when they got off the ship, they had all these attributes of wisdom and, you know, smartness on science and all this kind of stuff, being a superior aliens from somewhere else. The blonde-haired ones, the blue-eyed ones they describe as seeing. They formed a line there, and they got the white man first in line, and they got the Asian second in line, and they got the nigger third in line. And so the white man got all these attributes. He was first in line. Then the Asians got quite a bit, and it ended up the nigger didn't get anything. He was still operating like a primate. Just a theory. Well, that's it, boys and girls. I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to go out tonight if I'm able. My arm doesn't hurt too badly. Yeah, I'm going to go out there and celebrate my birthday. Yeah, I'm going to sing me some songs, have me a couple of drinks, and have a good time. I've hit the big 7-7. I never thought it'd last this long. Oh, man. 7-7, that's old. I'll see you tomorrow. Freya's Day. She-Wolf Day. Yeah, 14-5.
gentlemen, welcome to the main event. Let's get ready to rumble!
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling us.